Good morning. I'm speaking with Stephen Kinzer, a former award-winning foreign correspondent for the New York Times and author of a tremendous corpus of work that traces in detail U.S. interventions around the world. Some of his books include Bitter Fruit, The Untold Story of the American Coup in Guatemala, All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, The Brothers, John Foster and Alan Dulles in their secret world war, The True Flag about the birth of the American Empire, and most recently, Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA search for mind control. Kinzer has taught journalism and international relations at Northwestern and Boston universities. He is now a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University and writes a world affairs column for the Boston Globe. Welcome, Stephen Kinzer.
Well, after all that, it's great to be with you. Thanks.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today on KABU. A few months ago, after President Biden called Russian President Vladimir Putin a killer, Putin responded, "It takes one to know one," which the international press applauded because the rest of the world acknowledges the willful ignorance of most Americans to the long history of U.S. interventions in elections, overthrowing democracies, and initiating or sustaining wars around the globe. Let's talk about the origins of these interventions, drawing from your recent book, The True Flag. What is the significance of 1898 and the debates that occurred then about the U.S. role in the world?
Thanks for giving me the chance to talk about that, because it puts some great questions into the right perspective. So I was a foreign correspondent for many years. I worked for the New York Times in dozens of different countries, and I had a chance to watch history unfold right in front of me. After years of doing that, I began to wonder, what did it all mean? How does it all fit together? How did this start? In particular, where did the United States get this idea that we're in charge of the world, and if anything bad is happening, as we define bad, we have to intervene? No other country in the world has intervened so often in so many countries, so far away from its own borders over such a long period of time as the United States. So why is this? Now, the traditional answer was that it came after the end of World War II. Europe was devastated. We had the emergence of the Soviet Union. And Americans decided that the world was going to go into chaos if we didn't save it. But the more I began to look into the history of that era and the history of the whole 20th century, the more I concluded that was actually wrong, and that we didn't get into the business of trying to rule other countries after World War II. It actually happened earlier. It happened in the period around 1898. When the United States first seized its overseas territories like the Philippines and Puerto Rico, we took responsibility for Cuba. It was the beginning of the overseas empire. And what I found so fascinating in researching this period is that the debate over whether the United States should do this, whether a country dedicated to self-determination that had itself rebelled against an overseas imperialist colony could now become a colonizer and take over other countries. So this debate unfolded in the United States Senate over a period of about 5 weeks at the beginning of 1899. Everybody in the Senate was fully aware that they weren't just debating a treaty about whether to take the Philippines and Puerto Rico. They were debating the whole future of the United States. They all understood that, as one senator said, once we take this step, there's no going back to just being a country that minds our own business. So I found that period fantastically interesting. And since all my books are efforts to tell untold stories, stories that were really important in history, but that for whatever reason have been left behind, I jumped on that one, and that's what became The True Flag.
And of course, that part of the importance of that story, as you alluded to, is the fact that this is long before any Cold War. which justified so many interventions after World War II, as you pointed out. And there was a great deal of pushback. And in your book, you discuss the Anti-Imperialist League. Do you want to say something about that group?
One reason I was so interested in writing that book, The True Flag, is that I wanted to inform people today who are working towards reconciliation and peace with other nations and who oppose U.S. interventions and wars and bombing abroad that this is not a new idea. This is not a radical idea. In fact, this is an idea that's deeply rooted in American history. The people who are against American interventions in foreign wars today are standing on the shoulders of titans. I wanted to convey this sense that there have been generations of people in the United States that have fervently opposed this idea that the United States has come up with the perfect formula for ruling countries, and we must persuade or force every country in the world to accept this wonderful formula. It's not just now that people are rebelling against this. There have always been people who see the corporate interests, the economic interests that override what we pretend to be our interests, which are to bring human rights and civilization and peace to the rest of the world. So to try to show this commitment, this other side of the United States as a long continuum that has been going on for more than 100 years, I wanted to delve into what people thought and said back at the moment when the United States made that fateful decision to go from being a continental empire inside the United States to being an overseas empire that would take over other countries.
So there's always been this kind of opposition for over 100 years. And let's talk about some key examples of some interventions that may have been framed as successful at the moment, but as you have argued, history goes on. So what about the case of Iran in 1953 and the subsequent impacts, not only in Iran, but the rest of the region?
As you point out, the United States has so much power that when we decide we want to depose a government, we can do it. And certainly during the Cold War, we did it regularly and pretty easily. So that's a success. We set out to do it, and we do it. We want to get rid of a leader, and we get rid of him. But success becomes failure over years. And many of these interventions that seem successful at the time wind up not only devastating the target country, but also undermining the security of the United States. Iran is a perfect example. We're now engaged in this long back-and-forth shouting match with Iran, but I don't think many Americans understand that this all began not with the hostage crisis in 1979, but far before that in 1953. In the period after the Second World War, Iran had developed an incipient democracy. Because that government was democratic, it had to respond to the needs and the desires of the Iranian people. At that moment, there was one huge fact of life in Iran. It overwhelmed everything. It was that Iran is sitting on an ocean of oil, but all that oil is owned by one British company, which in turn is owned by the British government. It was natural that when a democratic government came to power in Iran, that would be the number one priority. Take back control of our oil so we can use the proceeds to develop our own country. Once the Iranian government did that, the outside world went into a panic. In 1953, the CIA, in cooperation with the British Secret Service, overthrew the government of Iran. And that wasn't just the overthrow of a single leader. It was the destruction of democracy in Iran forever, right up until this day. So that overthrow seemed like a success at the time in 1953. We got rid of a guy we didn't like, the old prime minister, Mossadegh, and we replaced him with a guy who would do everything we wanted. That was the Shah. So that seemed fine. But over 25 years, the Shah ruled with increasing repression. That repression produced the explosion of the late 1970s, the Islamic Revolution, as we call it. That revolution brought to power a clique of fanatically anti-American mullahs who have spent the last 40 years working intently and sometimes very violently to undermine American interests all over the world. That revolution also had huge other impacts. It terrified the Soviet Union because they were afraid radical Islam would penetrate their own Muslim republics. That's what led the Soviets in part to invade Afghanistan, which is what brought us into Afghanistan. We were also so angry at Iran for overthrowing our Shah that we began supporting Saddam Hussein in Iraq when he invaded Iran. That was the beginning of our death embrace with Saddam that led us into the quagmire in Iraq that we're still into. So a lot of history came from about 3 weeks in the summer of 1953. The event that seemed like such a brilliant success at the time, the overthrow of the Iranian democracy, has led us now into decades of trouble, and it's still going on. The effects of that intervention are still reverberating, and it's a perfect example of how operations that make us feel good for a few minutes actually wind up being bad for everybody.
And apparently that operation led to an operation the next year in 1954 Central America. Now, the United States had long bullied its neighbors in Latin America, but that history is also not known in this country, and then we fail to understand why so many people are fleeing poverty, violence, and oppression. So what happened in Guatemala in 1954 and then through the 1980s that helps explain the refugee crisis today?
The United States relationship with Central America has been very troubled and pained over more than a century. We've always considered the Central American countries to be, as we charmingly call them, banana republics, countries that need to do our bidding, small nations that essentially exist as fiefdoms for private American corporations. This is what Guatemala was up until the mid-1940s. United Fruit Company was the overwhelming fact of life in Guatemala. It owned the only electric company. It owned the only port from which products could be exported from Guatemala. It owned most of the arable land and had far more power than the Guatemalan government. In 1944, the old dictatorship was overthrown in Guatemala and democracy arrived. A similar process unfolded as was unfolding in Iran. The fact that you had a democracy in Guatemala meant that the government was finally going to have to respond to the needs of its people. Guatemalans were starving by the tens of thousands from lack of land. United Fruit had 500,000 acres of land that it didn't use. So a Land Reform Act was passed, in which United Fruit was required to sell its unused land to the Guatemalan government for distribution among landless peasant families. This terrified the United States. We got so angry that we determined to crush Guatemalan democracy. The fact that we'd been able to do this so easily the year before in Iran just gave momentum to this project. And sure enough, in 1954, the CIA organized a coup called Operation Success, in which the last democratic government Guatemala ever knew was overthrown. That produced the beginnings of a civil war that lasted for 30 years. Some 200,000 Guatemalans, mostly civilians from the Maya Indian area, were slaughtered. That's more people than were killed in political violence in the entire rest of Latin America during that period. This would never have happened had the United States not intervened, if we had allowed the democratic processes in Guatemala to mature. But we couldn't do that because allowing democracy to flourish in Guatemala and allowing capitalism to grow in Guatemala would be a threat to American corporate capitalism. So our unwillingness to share the wealth and to accept the idea that countries that produced resources have a right to benefit from those resources led us to crush governments and leaders who embodied what we like to think of as American ideals and replace them with tyrants who despise everything the United States is supposed to stand for.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm speaking with Stephen Kinzer, award-winning journalist and author of many books about U.S. interventions around the world. Stephen Kinzer, just given this long history of how so many years of interventions have proved to be failed policy, why does the United States continue these interventions?
It's a very interesting question that people in the international relations business are often pondering. I think a big part of the reason has to do with the pressure in Washington that is exercised by foreign governments through think tanks and by the arms industry. The weapons industry in America is enormously powerful. Not only does it sponsor campaigns for members of Congress, who then go on to vote for extremely expensive military procurement projects, but it does something even more pernicious. Whenever a big defense contractor gets a contract for some new weapon system, the first thing it does is it divides up the contract into subcontracts, and it puts those subcontracts into factories that are in the districts of all the members of Congress whose votes they need. Therefore, these members of Congress come to realize that if they vote against a hugely wasteful military procurement project, they're costing hundreds of people in their district jobs. So this is a highly effective system that has brought tremendous power to the arms industry and made it seem like a crime in Washington to suggest that the exercise of military power all over the world is not good for the United States. Now, I will say that I think in recent years, there has been a substantial change in the attitude of the American people toward these interventions. I think the disasters of Iraq and Afghanistan and other foreign adventures have really sobered many Americans. In addition, we look around our own country, we see how many crying needs we have at home, and we wonder how urgent it is that we have to bomb other countries into accepting our political system when our own system doesn't work very well at home. Unfortunately, the change in mentality that has taken over in the American public, and which is confirmed by repeated public opinion surveys, has not penetrated Washington. You haven't seen much of a change there. There's some. There's now a new think tank in Washington called the Quincy Institute. It's the first one that tries confront the right-wing and left-wing and Democratic and Republican coalition in favor of war and intervention. There are a few members of Congress who are speaking up now. But no doubt the American people, as is probably often the case, are ahead of Congress on this one.
Right. And just witness the last Pentagon budget that, you know, continues to increase despite the claims that we're pulling out of Afghanistan and pulling back some of these interventions to appease the American public, where there is growing opposition to these kinds of allocations of resources. Well, thank you so much, Stephen Kinzer, and really encourage listeners to read more of your work. You can find out about Stephen Kinzer's work at stephenkinzer.com. Thanks again.
Thank you.